This is Bill Downs in the State Department Auditorium in Washington, where CBS News brings you a special broadcast of the first news conference ever held by an American astronaut. Commander Alan Shepard shortly will tell for the first time in public how it feels to be shot 115 miles skyward at a speed of 5,100 miles per hour to become America's first man in space. The 37-year-old Navy commander is accompanied by his six fellow astronauts who are scheduled to follow him into space at some later date. The State Department Auditorium here is a new one where President Kennedy holds his news conferences about every week. It's jammed with reporters from all over the world. In fact, President Kennedy never drew a crowd like this. Also attending the conference and sitting in a place of honor in front of the auditorium are Commander Shepard's parents, Colonel and Mrs. Alan Shepard Sr. of Derry, New Hampshire, his wife's parents, Mr. and Mrs. Russell Brewer of Kennett Springs, Pennsylvania, and the astronaut's sister, Mrs. Gordon Sherman of Attleboro, Massachusetts. Earlier today, Shepard received the NASA Distinguished Service Medal from President Kennedy, who incidentally dropped it, and the astronaut made a surprise visit to the National Association of Broadcasters. But now the astronauts are coming in, receiving a big hand from this hard-bitten crowd of reporters. Commander Shepard has not yet made an appearance. He is to be accompanied by James E. Webb, the administrator. Yes, there he is now. And here is Administrator of the National Aeronautics and Space Agency, James E. Webb, who will introduce the astronaut.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The historic Project Mercury flight on last Friday was a dramatic demonstration before the eyes of the world of how the United States space team, through effective, large-scale, organized effort, can pass one very important milestone on the long road toward the mastery of the space environment by man. Symbolic of the successful solution of every problem and the accomplishment of every necessity to earn the Navy well done, or the NASA A-OK, is the man you desire to question, Alan B. Shepard, Jr. In fact, today, I think we can all say, it's Alan A. O.K. But before you ask your questions, let me give you a figure or two to indicate what it means to ride a rocket. A chronology published by the Congress shows that with respect to the V-2 rocket in Germany in 1942, out of seven launchings, only one succeeded. In 1943, out of 24, only four succeeded. After thousands of launches during the war, the record of the V-2 rockets built in the United States left much to be desired. With respect to the Jupiter rocket, out of the first 10 launchings, seven succeeded. Out of the second 10, eight succeeded. And out of the last four, everyone succeeded. And with respect to the Thor rocket, out of the first 10, four succeeded. After 40 firings of Thor, the next 10, that is from 40 to 50, all succeeded. And with respect to the Atlas rocket, out of the first 10, five succeeded. Out of the 10 from 20 to 30, all succeeded. But out of the 10 from 40 to 50, six succeeded and four failed. With respect to the Polaris rocket, out of the first 10, five succeeded. Out of the 10 from 40 to 50, seven succeeded. But out of the 10 from 70 to 80, nine succeeded. The lesson is clear. If we are to have our spectacular successes openly arrived at with ever larger and ever more complex rockets, the early test flights, unmanned of course, will involve some spectacular failures. In the drama of the countdown, we will never know which it is to be. But to keep perspective, I should tell you that, as we did in planning Project Mercury, this lack of rocket perfection will be taken into account in manned flights by providing an escape system for the astronaut in the event of the failure of the rocket. In thrust, the first stage of Saturn is 20 times the Redstone, and we will test fly it this year. In thrust, the first stage of Nova is estimated at 100 times the Redstone, and we are already testing one of its engines. The complete Nova will likely measure two-thirds as tall as the Washington Monument. From all we know about the past, a portion of the early test flights of these gigantic rockets will appear as failures to those who view them and read about them. To the space scientist and engineer, however, they will provide the knowledge, the experimental proof of a technology as a nation we cannot fail to master and still survive. In the months ahead, when you see on your TV the launchings of the brave men who sit beside Alan Shepard here today, it may be well to remember this record. Even with our best efforts, no specific flight can be guaranteed absolutely safe. But from every flight comes more knowledge to advance our progress in space. Now, to make the proper introductions, I present the director of NASA's Space Task Group, responsible for Project Mercury, a man who knows how it feels to send a man to ride a rocket, Robert R. Gilruth.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here with you on as happy an occasion as this one, I assure you. Before making my principal few words, I would like to identify the people here on the stage. If I can skip for a moment the man at my direct right, we have John Glenn, Gus Grissom, Scott Carpenter, Gordon Cooper, Wally Schirra, and Deke Slayton. And at the far right, Colonel Shorty Powers. On my left, next to Mr. Webb, is Walter Williams, Director of Operations. Dr. Douglas, the astronaut's flight surgeon. And Bill Lloyd. Al Shepard's flight is certainly a milestone in the space program. But I don't need to remind you that there are many tough flights ahead. As you know, in previous flights, we have involved a great team of many elements of Project Mercury. In last Friday's flight, however, a new system was added to the complex. That was man himself. I can assure you that Al Shepard was not only extremely cool during that long countdown, but during the flight performed a great job of test flying a new type of vehicle. He brought back a large amount of test data from that extremely intense but productive flight. I would now like to present the man who was there and who really broke the ice for all of us. Al.
Standing ovation from the world press and from his own fellow astronauts. That big A-OK grin is there. And now, America's first astronaut.
Thank you all very much. Before I make a short statement, I would like to introduce some further members of the audience, if they will please stand and turn around as I introduce them. My wife, Louise Shepard. And my mother and father, Mr. and Mrs. Shepard.
Thank you.
Sister Polly.
Reason for the laugh was Polly Shepherd stuck a gave and a boxer's handshake.
Mr. and Mrs. Brewer.
I really hadn't planned on saying anything today. I thought it was to be a more of a question and answer period, which I understand we're to get to in just a few minutes. I'm told that possibly to set the stage that I should say a few words, make a statement of some kind. And I think most of the details of the flight have been pretty well covered from the standpoint of how high we went and how far we went and how fast we went, how much weightless time, how the recovery went, and how the strenuous debriefing went. I think if you have any detailed questions on specific parts of the flight, that we can entertain those throughout the course of this hour. I would like to say, however, that we feel there are several significant things about this flight. Several of these statements have already been made today at the White House and on Capitol Hill. At the risk of repetition, however, I will say that we feel very strongly that this particular flight was one which was certainly accomplished in the open. We had very few secrets about our plans. Mostly launch dates were classified, but very little else was. This has been a little annoying to us at times, but I think we all rationalized with the thought that the free democratic society which produced us and which produced the Project Mercury flight certainly had a right to be presented in such a fashion. The second thought I would like to make at this point is that we are very proud of the manner in which the program was planned from the start, in which certain tendencies to speed up at times because of other events were carefully considered, evaluated, sometimes were taken and sometimes were discarded. I think the proof of that is in the fact that Friday's flight, short that it was, we found that we were able to do, as we understand it, a great number of things during that short period of time. For example, I actually controlled, in this case, the vehicle, its position during the retro firing. We controlled it during the reentry, and of course provided the backup for the mechanical systems aboard the capsule. All in all, we are very much pleased with the flight. We're very much encouraged by it. And we plan to press ahead with best possible speed to the successful completion of Project Mercury as we now know it. I think possibly at this point we might entertain your questions. Yes.
Would you mind giving us briefly how you felt at the time of ignition aside from the technical things that was on your mind?
Well, quite frankly, there were so many technical things in my mind at that point that I didn't assess any other feelings. I was surprised that the liftoff, that the ignition of the Redstone and the liftoff were as smooth as they were. I really had expected more noise and more vibration. Now, fortunately, we had provided enough padding around the earphones of the helmet, so the noise was not a problem. And the old Redstone itself was smooth enough so that it was a very pleasant liftoff.
Commander Shepard?
Yes, sir.
The skipper of the Champlain, the recovery ship on which some of us rode, told us that in conversation with you, you said that you experienced some unexpected sensations during the booster phase of the flight. And he implied that you said that at two points there was a turbulence that was unexpected. I gather that what you meant was that before the flight, instruments like the centrifuge and so forth had given you a preview of what you might expect, and these other things were unexpected. Is that so?
That's not quite correct. I'm sorry that it was taken in that context. What I was referring to at that time were two specific points in the flight plan, which we had adjudged ahead of time to be rather difficult from the standpoint of stress on the bird. One being the transonic region around Mach 1, and the other being the region of maximum dynamic pressure, that is a combination of air molecules and speed. We knew of these areas ahead of time from our previous flights. We just didn't know how to, or how well we would react. Fortunately, we found out that we reacted fairly well.
Commander.
Yes.
When you were up in the sky, you said, "What a beautiful sight." Where were you when you made that? Where were you, Commander, and what did you see?
Well, the remark was made just after I had been doing some experimental maneuvers using the manual handle to control the movements of the capsule. At this point, our flight plan called for a look through the periscope to assess our ability to identify targets, to control the attitude of the capsule and so on, using the periscope alone. I had been pretty well briefed on the land masses as they should appear and the cloud cover as it should have appeared. And I had seen pictures which we had tried to use to portray this view. But when I first looked from the instrument panel using a gyroscopic indication down to the periscope itself, I must admit it sort of took my breath away. It was a beautiful view. Yes, over there.
Do you have any idea of the rate of onset of your deceleration?
You mean in G per second?
Yes.
Let's see. We went to a maximum of a little over 11 G, as I recall, and the total time period from 0G to 11 back to 1, I think, is around 30 seconds. Is this correct? They haven't let me see the records of the flight yet. We deliberately, down at Grand Bahamas, debriefed completely from memory so that we wouldn't have any other outside influences. And we hope in a few days to be able to look at the complete records now and compare the two.
Commander?
Yes, right here.
What was the worst part of your flight?
I don't think we had any bad moments at all, as I recall.
I understand you had a bet with Colonel Glenn about your ability to recognize any constellations. I was wondering if you did, and did you spot any constellations? What was the bet also?
John, you want to tell him about that?
Why don't you go up, tell him.
Replies to that question.
Actually, this got misconstrued someplace along the line into a dispute between Al and I, and actually it's Gus and I over here that have been discussing the stars all this time. I should kick it on over to Gus and let him describe it. We had wondered whether we could see the stars. I felt that we probably could, even on a short flight like this. Al did try and see the stars out through the window, and I'm still claiming foul because I claim that there was not enough time left for his eyes to adapt at that time, and Gus claims this is final proof at the moment, so I'm going to have to pay off with the steak dinner that we did bet on this, I guess, but I'm looking forward to later flights when we can prove that we can see stars, and I'll get a double dinner back.
Astronaut Powers.
Please, if you can, maybe this has been used before, I don't know, but will you tell us, if you know, why you were picked And is there any reason for the fact that most of you are about the same height and that you're not very tall?
I'm afraid I'll have to disqualify myself when it comes to answering that particular question. I don't know whether Mr. Gilbreth would care to comment or not. No comment, sorry.
Can you
Jules?
Tell us why you appeared, or can he tell us? It must
I
be
say something. We disqualify ourselves, too.
You disqualify, so he will.
I'd like to ask you to relax on that question. I think it's very obvious that we did a good job.
Alan, how different was the overall ride from what you had previously expected from training?
The overall ride actually was very close to what we had predicted. Fortunately, as you know, we had two similar configurations, that is, a mercury capsule and redstone, to show us the way. This combined with the procedures trainer, as we call it, which is a glorified link trainer, navigational trainer, from the standpoint of learning times and sequence of events, actually proved to be a very good training device, so that I really didn't feel uncomfortable or embarrassed at any time during the flight. Yes, way back there.
Could you explain to us how you felt during that 5 minutes of weightlessness? Could you move your hands? Could you manipulate? Could it have any effect on your attack of the plane?
Well, all of a sudden, during the period of the middle of the weightlessness, I realized that somebody was going to ask me that question. So... So I said to myself, you'd better figure out an answer. Seriously, as we have said before, during the short periods of weightlessness that we've experienced during our training period, it's quite a pleasant sensation. Particularly so after the accelerations of the booster ride, we find that we have no difficulty in maneuvering ourselves, in controlling ourselves, and really is at this point, certainly, given us no difficulty at all.
Right here. Commander, could you give us some idea of what you were doing and perhaps what you were thinking during that very long wait on the pad before the launch? You were up there about 4 hours. How did you occupy your time?
Well, the period in the capsule was indeed much longer than we had expected. I think that with due consideration to the amount of time, it was encouraging because the operations director checked with me from time to time, of course, over the various circuits that we enjoyed to find out how I was doing, and we kept going on the basis that I indeed did feel quite comfortable. Aside from that, there were many functions to perform inside the capsule, such as throwing switches one way or another depending upon the particular phase of the countdown. I must admit that I had very little time to reflect during that period. Right here.
There was a report before you left the carrier that you went back to the capsule and got out some personal belongings. Did you carry any personal belongings aside from your uniform, your spacesuit? And if so, what were they?
Actually, I wanted to take that opportunity to go back to look inside the capsule. I didn't know whether I'd have a chance to see it again or not. I did pick up my helmet. I had my Naval Academy ring with me. That's all. Yes.
What are you dreaming of next? Are you already thinking about taking that orbit around the Earth?
Well, as has been pointed out here, our immediate plans are to continue ahead with Project Mercury as we know it. The final objective of Mercury is orbital flight using the same type of capsule that we used last Friday. Beyond that, we are not specifically involved in any plans.
Would you like to do the flight around the Earth?
All seven of us would.
Did you at any moment during the flight, or even before the flight, feel any, at all, any exhilaration or apprehension?
Well, I must say there was some apprehension, yes. I think that, we went into this thing with our eyes open, but all of us realized the possibilities of a partial success or failure. So there was apprehension. There's no question about that. The only exhilaration I felt was after the landing and the recovery had been completed. How about right back there?
Commander, I'm from Salem, New Hampshire, a neighbor of yours. I would like to know that at the moment that you realized, while you were in the sky, that this was a success, what was your first thought that you had?
Well, if I may correct that statement, again, I didn't really feel the flight was a success until the recovery had been successfully completed.
I mean, that you were satisfied in your own mind that you were going to hit that water and this was the end of the line, and that you were evidently going to get out of
the cabin. It's not the fall that hurts, it's a sudden stop. Yes.
I wonder if you could ask all of those fellows on your right, including Shorty, which one would like to take the next ride?
How about a show of hands?
Can you tell us, take it back a little bit further past the actual time you got in the cone, and tell us how you felt the night before, what you did to relax.
I'm not sure I was relaxed. We were on a special low-residue diet. Of course, we exercised, and we briefed prior to the flight. All these things, of course, took time. And I would say the majority of my attention was on the preparation for the flight itself. Right here.
I'm interested in a couple more details. One, at the launch pad in the morning, I noticed when you got out of the van, you stepped aside and you looked it up and down and then looked it up and down a second time. I'd like a little more background on that. And the second thing I'd like a little more background on is during the flight and re-entering the atmosphere, Shorty Powers, and typing it to the press, said that your voice showed some strain. I wonder if you can give us a little more background on those two points in your flight.
Well, I'll take care of the first one. I realized that I might never see the outside of that missile again, and I thought it was appropriate to look it over. As far as what Shorty said about the strain of my voice, maybe he'd like to comment.
Colonel Powers, the man who did the countdown of the flight.
I think perhaps strain was the wrong word. As most of you know, while you're under high G, or perhaps you don't know, when you're under high G, there is a system of straining. You can strain your stomach muscles and your leg muscles so as to resist the effect of G. And it was audible from Al's voice transmission that he was in fact straining. This was the same sound that we've heard a number of times over the loudspeaker systems at the centrifuge and during other training activities.
So there. Okay, right over here in front.
To whom are you referring when you say we? We went so far and we went so high. Are you talking about the other astronauts or the guys on the ground?
Well, I think that maybe it's appropriate this time, as I said before, earlier today, that I am acutely aware of the hundreds of individuals who made this flight possible.
Question. During the war, there was a rather famous pilot who wrote a book called God Was My Co-Pilot. Did you feel the same way?
I think that that all seven of us have a religious faith, which we express in our own individual ways. I think that's about all I'd care to comment. Yes, Miss Craig?
I don't know whether you can answer this or not. Does your experience best qualify you to go the next time, or will they try others so to train them?
Well, suppose I give you my answer, and then I'll give you the answer that these fellows will say. My answer is, of course, I feel, perhaps an advantage from having made this flight. Their answer is, or should be, that they should be encouraged that our training program prepared us so well for this flight and would not necessarily mean that I or the next Redstone pilot would have to make the first orbital flight. Yes, right here.
You did have one anxious moment, I believe, when the retro rocket light, the release light, failed to come on. Could you tell us about that?
Has this been discussed?
I don't know.
Well, there are several things, of course, that happened throughout the flight. Capsule separation, turnaround, so on. And one of these is the jettisoning or the breaking away of the retro rocket package after the retros had fired prior to re-entering the atmosphere. This, in fact, did happen right on schedule. The package ejected, and I saw bits of strap flying around through the periscope and by the window. Deke confirmed it over radio from the ground. At this time, the light inside the capsule, which is also supposed to confirm it, had not lighted. I used the manual override switch just to be sure that the event had occurred. At this particular time, the light lighted and everything proceeded normally. Yes, right.
So I understand that you had an option either to ride the capsule onto the carrier or to get out as you did and go aboard the helicopter. Some of us thought perhaps in view of the tragedy of the day before that it would have been much safer to have remained in the capsule. Can you tell us why you selected to go the other way?
Well, first let me say that we are all very sorry. We were very sorry to hear of that particular event. And I think, unfortunate though it may be, putting it in its proper context, the helicopter has been a very successful device, as you know, for many years. It was felt that there was no need to change our recovery plans. Yes.
Commander, we were not able to see the stars. Did you catch a glimpse of the moon through your window?
No. Unfortunately, we had, had we gone off close to 7 o'clock, we had a nice array. The moon, Venus, and Saturn were in the southwest, fairly close to the horizon, which is the direction that the porthole on the left side looked or faced. As you know, we had some hold time. As a result, the moon had already set by the time we got up at the apogee. Yes, sir.
Tell us why you got out of the capsule and went in the helicopter back to the ship.
Yes, and let me explain it this way. Mr. Gilruth has been a leading proponent for the past 2 years of providing parallel systems in Project Mercury. By this I mean that should one path for an event fail, the other is always there to provide the reliability. After some discussions about a month or 6 weeks ago, we decided that the one cable on the helicopter was indeed not a parallel path. The method we used Friday was one that we devised ahead of time to give us that additional reliability.
Well,
How much of the Earth's surface could you see?
I'm sorry, the gentleman first, please.
How much of the Earth's surface could you see when you saw that beautiful sight?
Well, part of my view of the Earth's surface was obscured by clouds, primarily up in the northwesterly direction from the apogee point. The distance from the point immediately below the capsule out to the horizon of vision is about 800 miles using the periscope. Yes.
I would like to ask you, I'm sure everyone would be very interested to hear, how did the heavy gravity affect you? How did you feel? And did it affect your eyes? And do you think possibly you might not have seen stars because the weightlessness affected your eyes? Could you explain a little bit about this?
I'd be glad to.
You must have felt like you were weighed between 1,000 and 1,500 pounds. I wonder how that felt.
Well, fortunately, we have a device called a centrifuge, which is, we've described it before as being an oversized cream separator. It whirls you around on the end of a long arm and provides artificial gravitational forces. We have used a couple of these devices and investigated these fields. And as far as we have gone in the G tolerance, which is well above what we expect on a normal flight, we found that we have very little difficulty. There, at the extreme levels of G, peripheral vision decreases just prior to blackout or grayout. It is more difficult to breathe because of the pure mechanics of lifting a heavier chest structure. But even so, through this training program, we found that we were able to do very well, and I think that Friday's performance...
there than it had been in training.
No, we deliberately went to higher levels of investigation on an orderly basis to find out what we indeed could take. And last Friday's flight was well below those minimums. Maximums, I should say. Right here?
Sir, how long before the flight did you know that you were hit, and how were you told?
Sometime. Time enough, sir. My suit was down at Cape Canaveral. That's it right there.
At what stage did you suffer the greatest physical stress? Blast off, reentry, or where?
Well, I think the stage at which I suffered the greatest stress was after recovery. And this was primarily my own fault. As long as we're in the capsule, we're ventilated inside the pressure suit by ventilation system. As I went out of the capsule, I disconnected, of course, from this ventilation system, went up into the helicopter, back to the aircraft carrier, and on down below decks before I finally took my pressure suit off. And I was pretty warm at that time. Outside of that, there's no evidence of any real physiological stress. How about right in the middle there?
The Soviet...
Brown suit? You.
One of the big unknowns before the flight was the effect of the abrupt transition from weightlessness to heavy G's. What about that?
I noticed really no rough transition at all. All of the transitions from the boosted acceleration through cutoff, which is a gradual, relatively gradual function, and through the zero G and back into the re-entry G. All of these were gradual transitions. I was really quite pleased in the smoothness of it all. How about on the end of the...
Commander, on your re-entry into the atmosphere when you were coming down through, was there any heat problem within the capsule?
No. No, the capsule is designed to withstand the heat stress of re-entry from orbital velocity, which is higher than the a redstone re-entry velocity. We found no difficulty at all. Right here.
Commander Stewart.
In the front, please. Sorry.
Commander, you were quoted as saying that you felt the trip was too short. How long do you feel you could stay up, and did you recommend that the next trip be longer?
Well, if I could categorically answer your question as to the length of time we could stay up, then I think we could rearrange our future schedule for Project Mercury. We intend to investigate on a bit-by-bit basis what man's tolerance is to the weightless condition. Yes.
As a celebrity of whom we are all very proud, no one has yet asked you how you would solve the world's problems. And I'm wondering, would you entertain...
I hope they don't.
Would you entertain a philosophical question in this field? It's going to cost so many billions of dollars future space exploration. I wonder how you personally feel about... cooperating with all the other nations of the world, Russia, if we can get them, and everyone to avoid duplications. Do you have any feelings yourself on that?
I do, but I'd rather not express them at this time. Yes, in the... Yes.
Astronaut, do we, writing about you, do we call you the senior astronaut or Commander Shepard, the first astronaut?
Well, as long as you say nice things, I don't care.
Sort of a message from the cosmonaut Gagarin. Congratulations at this date.
Not to my knowledge. I have not, of course, seen all of the wires and cables. I understand that Khrushchev expressed his opinions of the flight to the president. We, to my knowledge, have received no other congratulatory messages from that source. Right here in the front.
How do you feel about the attitude control? Are you completely satisfied with the way it worked and the way you were able to work it?
Yes, I am. As a matter of fact, Gus and I were discussing that just the other day. Maybe you'd like to make a comment on the manual control system, Gus?
Astronaut Gus Grissom.
Well, as you may know, the control system has been one of my specialty areas. And I guess I got more and more concerned as launch time arrived. And just a few days before flight, we'd run into a little problem of some of the valves binding and heavy control forces. So Al and I had sat down and talked this thing over very thoroughly and decided what to do. And I'm very grateful he had to do none of those. The system worked just perfect.
You may have it back, Al.
That was Air Force Captain Virgil Grissom.
Sir, could you tell us in a very plain language what will we benefit from all these flights, humanity? What will be the benefit of humanity from these flights? Will our standards be better, or how will our life affect these flights?
That's really very difficult to describe. I think I could best answer it by saying that we expect to make advances in the fields of high temperature because of designing against the high temperatures of reentry. We expect to make advances in knowledge of radiation sciences because of the need to penetrate the Van Allen belts on deep space probes. These things that I think are... you treat in a general way. Sometimes you don't really know specifically what you're going to find, particularly in the manned case. Now, there have been a lot of probes, for example, weather probes, radiation probes, instruments carried aloft for some specific purpose. These, I think, you pretty well know ahead of time in what area to get an answer. I think the real answer is that you just don't know at this point. There are so many unknowns that we just don't know how we'll benefit. But in those general areas, I'm sure we will. Right here.
Did you and your colleagues learn anything as a result of Friday's experience which will accelerate the orbital flight? I mean, bring the time of the flight closer.
Mr. Gilworth, would you care to comment on that?
Project Mercury Operations Director, well, Robert Gilbert.
I don't think in a program as complex and involves many elements as Project Mercury does, the passing of a particular milestone
accelerates it, but I can certainly say that this past flight did not decelerate it.
Yes, right here.
From the experience of this flight, will you recommend any changes in the equipment in the capsule, either in the equipment or the way it's presented? And one second part before I got you. Would you want a second Mercury flight before you would try an orbital flight?
In answer to the first question, the changes that I recommended as a result of my flight were minor and very few in number. All in all, we were very well satisfied with the performance of the capsule. Secondly, would I want another Redstone flight? This is a hypothetical one, of course, if I were to make the first orbital flight. No. Yes.
Redstone had boosted you into suborbital flight before Yuri Gagarin made his trip last month.
Could it have?
Could it have?
Yes. Technology advanced enough to do that?
The answer to that is yes. We could have. We could have gone a lot earlier. As you may remember in my opening remarks, I tried to describe the orderly basis upon which we proceeded with Project Mercury. All of us who are here on the stage now were in and are in complete agreement with the way this program is laid out. There were times when we could have rushed the program. We chose not to.
Why? Why did you not do it before they did? If we could have.
Yes, primarily because we felt that we had a well laid out, well designed, reliable program. And I think possibly you know that we have been, this view has been substantiated several times by various committees. Way in the back.
After the orbital flights are completed, what, in your personal opinion, should be the next goal for our manned space program? Should it be the moon?
Well, I'd rather not comment on that one. Would you like to handle that one, Mr. Webb?
James Webb, administrator of NASA.
Of course, we're going to try to expand the use of the Mercury capsule into extended flights. Then we have programs for thorough exploration of the environment around the Earth, around the Moon, in between the two. We have plans for the Apollo 3 manned orbiting laboratory, and this is capable of expansion to make a three-man trip around the Moon and return. And, of course, the same vehicle or parts of it will be used for the effort for the first lunar landing. So there's an orderly process in which we learn from each step and move on to the next.
All right, how about the lady in the...
Commander, did you find any discrepancies in what Yuri Gagarin reported and what you experienced?
Well, actually, I'd rather not comment on that particular one because those of us here really had so much to do on our program that we didn't really delve into the data from his flight other than what was presented in the newspaper accounts. So without more specific data, we couldn't really say.
Commander, with what definition are you able to make out the Earth?
Yes. I think this is on tape also. That I was able to distinguish various landmarks of various sizes. I had hoped to be able to see Cape Hatteras, which was in our field of vision, but it was obscured by cloud cover. I was able to see very clearly, of course, the Florida Peninsula and Lake Okeechobee. Andros Island and Bimini were visible. I had hoped to be able to identify the Bahamas, but unfortunately, they were obscured partially by clouds, and I did not identify them as such, even though I knew they were there. We were quite pleased with the ability to be able to see out of the periscope from that altitude. Yes.
Do you feel that doing this project out in the open, as you did, and particularly with the advanced publicity, did that impose any extra burdens on the people who were responsible for carrying it out?
Yes, I think it did. I think perhaps Shorty might want to comment on that because he's the one that had to bear the brunt of all of the requests. Would you care to say something on it?
This is Colonel John Powers coming to answer that question about coverage.
I'll answer that before he starts.
I think Mr. Bob Gilruth would agree with me. We've talked about this quite a bit. We were seriously concerned over any possible pressure exerted on the engineers, on our operations people, and the technicians doing this very difficult job that might have resulted from the large amount of news media exposure. I worked very hard, therefore, to try and protect them. I feel that that was one of the responsibilities I had. And the reason that you might not have been able to do, if you were down at Cape Canaveral during this operation, all of the things that you might have wanted to do, it was simply because we were trying to assure ourselves and the engineers that had to do the job an opportunity to do it without undue outside influence. I think we succeeded in that regard. Would you agree with that, Mr. Gilruth? This is the old middle ground where we tried to satisfy your requirements to make sure that we transmitted all of the information about the program promptly and candidly, and at the same time protected the people that had to do the job so that they could do it right. Thank you.
I'd like to say just one word there. The instructions given all the way from the highest level of government down were to go when ready. And not to take into account those particular items under discussion here.
That was James Webb, director
of NASA. Can't talk about any discrepancies that you may have found. Can you say at least whether they might have caused you to have some doubts as to whether Gagarin actually accomplished what he said he accomplished?
Well, first of all, let me clarify the reason why we're not talking about discrepancies, and that primarily is because we found none. The ones we found were very minor, minor nature. We anticipate any delay at all in the program as a result of the few little changes that we're going to make. Well, as I said before, I'd rather not compare the two flights. We, of course, are very proud of what we've done, and we are encouraged to continue on in our program. I beg your pardon?
Did you yourself feel competitive toward the Soviets?
Competitive? What do you mean competitive?
That you were trying to do something that was in the same area they were working in. Did you have a sense of competition, you and the other members of the group?
Well, as we all said after his flight, we were very much disappointed. And I think we'll let it go at that. Yes.
On the basis of your flight, would you recommend any changes in the training program to better meet the stresses and strains of future flights or longer flights?
No, as a matter of fact, that was one of the items that we discussed down at the Bahamas. And in general, we were very much satisfied with the training program. The one or two trainers that we use that we may not use in the future, but in general, all the trainers and all the educational process that we went through was most satisfactory. Yes.
Well, I think we've tried your patience a long time now, but may we have the heroine of the occasion stand up beside you?
Right, pardon?
We'd like to have the heroine of the occasion stand up beside you.
Yes, would you like to stand up here for a few minutes?
Welcome to the podium. Photographers are clustering around. He's still wearing that white orchid. This conference has been going on for almost 55 minutes now, but no one seems to be tired. After all, this is the first time that Commander Shepard has had a chance to talk publicly about this, and he seems to enjoy getting the facts and his impressions and feelings off his chest. The six other astronauts also are standing by.
Yes.
And the interesting thing about this, Commander Powers always refers to Mercury Project as we.
Beaten the Russians in the first flight. Do you think, one, we have been too cautious in our program, and two, do you see any possibility that it could be speeded up to where we might catch up to their present position?
Well, it's always easier to look back on Saturday's game on Monday morning. It's very difficult to make decisions ahead of time. I think that Mr. Webb and Mr. Gilruth, as well as I, have indicated that we have been satisfied with the progress of Mercury. We have speeded up in areas of which you are not aware, and the general directive was to go when ready, and we did. Yes.
Commander Shepard, would you mind telling us when you last talked with your lovely wife, Louise, before you blasted off, and if it's not too personal, a little comment on what you and she said by telephone?
When I last talked to her by phone, you mean? Well, I spoke to her the night before the shot, before the flight. And it is personal.
Commander, at any time since the time you were first picked to be an astronaut until liftoff, did you wish you were in something else other than Project Mercury?
That's the easiest question I've had today. No.
First public description of an American in space. Navy Commander Alan Shepard unburdened himself with, in a great good humor. He seems fit. He seems happy. But always you had the feeling he was not talking only about himself, but about, a few hundred other people. Same thing happened, you might remember if you're old enough, when a man named Lindbergh flew the Atlantic Ocean in a plane. He always referred to that project as we too. So this news conference really was a conference of a great group of people, including on the platform today were Air Force Major Donald Slayton, Navy Commander Walter Shearer, Air Force Captain Leroy Cooper, Navy Commander Scott Carpenter, Air Force Captain Virgil Grissom, Marine Corps Colonel John Glenn, and, of course, America's first astronaut, Alan Shepard. This was a group operation, and the next man, we understand, quite possibly would be to go up in a Mercury capsule, quite possibly will be Gus Grissom, Shepard's closest friend, the man who stayed up all night with him the night before he flew, and then watched him as he slept after that flight. It's been an eventful day. The astronauts, Mr. and Mrs. Shepard, and the in-laws now go to a luncheon at the Green Room here in the new State Department building. They will be the guests of Vice President and Mrs. Lyndon Johnson, with Undersecretary of State Chester Bowles representing the Secretary of State. Present will be the Secretary of the Navy, John B. Connolly, and the Commissioner of the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission, John S. Graham, representing the Chairman of the Commission, who I believe is in Geneva, and Dr. Edward C. Welch, Executive Secretary of the National Aeronautics and Space Council. Also at that luncheon will be Dr. Jerome B. Wisner, Special Assistant to the President for Science and Technology, and representing Congress, Senator Robert S. Kerr, Chairman of the Senate Committee on Aeronautical and Space Sciences, Congressman Overton Brooks, Chairman of the House Committee on Science and Aeronautics and Astronautics, and Senator Stiles Bridges, a member of the Senate Committee on Aeronautical and Space Sciences, as well as Congressman Joseph W. Martin, Jr. The one thing that has stood out in this entire accolade being given to astronaut Alan Shepard today is the basic modesty of the man. His response to all this hero worship has been one of complete sharing. When President Kennedy pinned the NASA Distinguished Service Medal on him at the White House lawn today, incidentally, the president dropped it. He said the medal was not for him particularly, but for the hundreds who made it possible to put that red stone rocket on its pad and that Mercury space capsule in the air. So throughout, it's been a we operation, and as he pointed out at his news conference, it has been conducted openly and freely. This is Bill Downs reporting from the State Department Auditorium in Washington. CBS News has brought you a special program. We now resume our scheduled program on your CBS radio station.